thanks for joining us once again for this ongoing series we're doing this summer, which is treating what I'm calling the biblical roots of the American Republic. This is really an extension of a series we've been doing over the last couple of years that began with a consideration of the role played by Presbyterians, you may recall, in the American Revolution. From there, we took a look at some of the details of the American Constitution itself, and now we're trying to dig back into the biblical roots that were really very important in many cases to the founding fathers as they were attempting to craft some idea of how to do American government, sort of creating this out of whole cloth, you know. And so that's what we're trying to do in this brief series. Last time we were together, we were looking at the basic distinction between two kinds of political philosophies in this world. There is, on the one hand, those who try to gin up, you might say, a system of authority from out of human sources without any reference to outside authority, certainly not God or heaven or anything like that. And of course, typically what happens in that kind of situation is that eventually whoever has the greatest amount of power, raw power, is able to dictate the terms of the game. Sometimes it's more benign, but generally speaking, it tends to move in a direction that's not so healthy, you know. The old expression, absolute power corrupts absolutely, continues to hold true as it has from the beginning of time. And that is the great peril of governmental systems that try to create some sort of political authority simply out of human sources alone. That's the really the one of the most sad things, you might say, in considering the history of political experiments, is that particular detail. And so we looked at that. We noted that Aristotle probably does the most sophisticated ancient attempt to find some way to balance the power struggle, the more or less balancing, you might say, democratic forces against aristocratic, and trying to cobble together something that would more or less prevent either side from exercising undue power. But obviously that has limited limited ability to really accomplish the intended objective. The other approach is to frankly acknowledge that there is authority from outside our human situation, that there is God in heaven, and that God has created us, and that God has given to us the ability to craft some sort of political institutions, a body politic, but we need to do that recognizing the God of heaven, and manifestly that was the view of the founders. I'm not saying that's necessarily the view today. We've certainly drifted a bit from the original foundations, but our attempt right now is simply to look at what the original vision was and the declaration, really the philosophical underpinnings, you might say, of this experiment really can be traced back to Jefferson and others who stated we were endowed by our Creator. We were created with certain unalienable rights and so on. You're familiar with that. Well, today we want to shift the focus and say, okay, if that's the way government is established, if it looks to authority from outside ourselves, how do we reflect that in the way that we view ourselves? In other words, what's the consequence of that? If God, as it were, is the source, the cause of the authority, then what's the effect? What does it have to do with our vision of ourselves, and how does it, in a sense, influence how we go about the creation of a political body? Well, I'm going to call this generally the idea of the principle of human worth. My hypothesis is here that if we recognize God in heaven is the source of true authority, then the effect of that on human beings is going to be to elevate our sense of human worth and our sense of human dignity. That in a sense, it's not going to deprive us of those, but actually accentuate them. I've heard that point, of course, debated sometime. In fact, if you're familiar with Humanist Manifesto that was published around the turn of the 20th century, the Huxleys and others put together this document that basically repudiated outright the God hypothesis and said that they were doing that in order to elevate human dignity. They thought that if God is in heaven, that it deprives us of something of our dignity. I always thought that's kind of an interesting idea, you know. If there's no God in heaven, then how do we account for our existence? At best, we have to say it's just an accident, purposeless, meaningless, event that took place at some point, kind of a little mishap that took place in a mud puddle, and eventually out crawls a human being. And that human being is destined for annihilation. That's the bottom line. How we exactly have dignity in the meantime is a mystery to me, but there are those who take that view. I heard one modern commentator, maybe I should say one commentator on modern humanity, make the point or say the little phrase, man, by the modern view of things, is a grown-up germ living on the cog of a wheel of a vast cosmic machine destined for destruction. Now, if you can figure out how to pull dignity out of that in the meantime, then you're a better person than I am. The traditional view is that if God is in heaven, if God is in fact the author of our creation, this God who is utterly holy, transcendently majestic, can give to us his dignity, and that really is the only source by which we can derive any idea of dignity. Well, that core gives rise to three basic principles. I'm going to suggest to you that if you think about what is distinctively, classically American. Now, I realize that we live in somewhat tumultuous times, and so some of these ideas may be debatable at the moment. But if we ask, where was the view of things, if we trace back through American history, our idea of ourselves? In fact, if to this day you were to tour around the world and just ask people at random, what their view traditionally is of America. Why is it that there's no nation in the world that people have a more passionate desire to come to than this country? Why is it that we've been such a magnet to people from all over the world? They're willing to come here legally and in many cases illegally. They just want to get to America. What is it? What is it about this place that really has been responsible for that? Now, you may differ at this, but I'm going to suggest three terms that I think may describe the reasons for this. The first one I'm going to call unity. The national phrase, e pluribus unum, out of the many, one. The idea that as a nation, we have one united idea of ourselves. We are one nation under God. Our Constitution specifically prohibits titles of entitlement. That is to say that we have some kind of titles of nobility, the term I was looking for there. We don't have lords and barons. We don't have dukes and ladies and that kind of thing. We don't have those titles. We view everybody as coming into this world on equal turf. We don't believe that there should be a caste system. We don't think some people come in here as aristocrats and some people come in here as common. We just don't believe that. We've repudiated that. There was an expression that passed around some of the saloons and bars back in the colonial days. We serve no sovereign here. If you claim to be a sovereign, you're going to have to take your business elsewhere. We have a strong, deep sense that we are one people and that there's a kind of unity that ties us together. That's been a traditional American notion, and it certainly is one idea that people would think about in connection with our experiment here in the United States. Another would be the notion of liberty. We have an idea that in this nation, people are free. We have a Statue of Liberty that was given to us by France, of course, but it really does carry the idea that we are a free people, and that's been the traditional view. We sing in the national anthem, we're the land of the free and the home of the brave. We believe that we have liberty and justice for all. That idea is one of the most common and widespread views of how we live here in the United States. Now, again, of course, there's always governmental forces that are trying to deprive you of your freedom. I don't need to tell you that. We live with that every day. But even in spite of that, there is a deep sense that liberty lies at the heart of who we are and what we are. And finally, I would say the notion of equality needs to be mentioned. I mentioned last time we were together, Lady Justice is blindfolded. That's to make sure that there's equal protection under the law, enshrined in the 14th Amendment, and certainly the Constitution generally stands for that idea, equal protection. That no matter who you are, no matter what your socioeconomic status might be, nevertheless, you have the guarantee that you'll have equal protection. Now, I grant you, we don't really realize all of those. They are aspirational. We're always pressing toward that. We certainly have some black eyes in our history. We know the blight of slavery. We know all of those things are part of our history. We don't try to hide it. But nevertheless, we have an objective. We have something we're pursuing. And that's been very much a part of our national self-interest and our self-identity, our self-image. And again, I think you'd say that really around the world, to some degree, people would view us in that way. So what I'd like to do is take a look at each of those just briefly and ask the question, where did those ideas come from? Certainly at the time, I'm going to just tell you this, at the time that the Constitution of the United States was being framed and those values were being enshrined, you would have to say we were doing something that was almost completely unprecedented. You wouldn't find any nation in the world that had committed itself philosophically to those ideas. And yet here we are, trying with a straight face to make those the underpinnings of our whole understanding of how to do a political system. Well, where did that come from, you know? I've argued before that, of course, in general terms, you'd say it came from the Reformed wing of the Protestant Reformation, but that doesn't quite answer the question adequately, because where did the Reformed wing get it? And you'd have to say it goes back to the Scriptures. And certainly the Founding Fathers were deeply conversant with the Scriptures. Even those who weren't necessarily Bible-believing Christians were nevertheless deeply schooled and quite familiar with biblical instruction, and in many cases very sympathetic with some of the instructions that we run into in the Bible. So I'd like to look at each of those three ideas that I just mentioned and see where we might be able to trace them down in terms of biblical sources. The answer, in the short answer, is certainly we find all of these ideas reflected in Moses and the law that he gave to the children of Israel after they came out of the land of Egypt. And if you were to say, well, where did Moses get it? You know, I'm going to tell you, you can go do your own research if you want, but it didn't come from any contemporary ancient civilization that Moses would have been familiar with, certainly not Egypt. Egypt had a highly stratified society. This would not be any idea that came from them. It wouldn't come from the Persians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians. Any of the great civilizations of the ancient world would have found these ideas totally foreign and really quite almost unimaginable that someone would develop ideas that we do find more or less overtly and quite conspicuously in Moses. Moses rejects the idea of higher and lower classes. He rejects the idea of nobility in common. Louis XIV famously said, "I am the state," you know, but in Moses you'll find nothing like that. Other ancient civilizations tended to create an impassable gulf. So if you were born into one particular class or caste, that's where you were pretty much locked in, and with very, very few exceptions, you were going to live and die at that particular level, and your worth as a human being was dictated in large measure by the class into which you were born. Well, Moses comes along and basically abolishes the whole idea of caste. And out of that, we have the notion arising of a notion of equal rights. The whole people form the state. Now, you can find this in many places in Moses' writings, but I'm going to take you to one of the most important and maybe central of these, and that would be the preamble of the Ten Commandments. Some people have said the Ten Commandments actually represent the first declaration of the universal rights of man. You know, now, I don't know if you ever thought about the Ten Commandments that way. But if you reflect on it for a moment, I think you'll see why such a statement would be made. You know, it's the Ten Commandments that says, "Thou shalt not steal." Well, that's a prohibition on what I can do, but it's also a protection of me against you stealing from me. You know, the Ten Commandments are not only creating restrictions as to what I can do, but also a barrier of protection that guards from what you can do to me. And in some ways, that says within that domain, within that province of my own personal life and so on, I'm free to live my life without necessarily facing some kind of intrusion from outside forces. Well, that is addressed to all of the people under Moses' code that is given to us. And then the Ten Commandments, the preamble, you have this statement, "I am Yahweh, I'm the Lord, thy God." Now, the reason I use the word "thy" there is because in ancient English, the King James English, if you will, Thy meant the singular. Ye is the plural, you know. And in the Hebrew, they do distinguish between singular and plural. Most languages do. We in English have the same word for both. We say you, singular, you, plural. And that sometimes is a little confusing when we read the scriptures, but it's made more clear if you recognize that when the scripture says, I am Yahweh, your God, thy God, it means you, singular. Now that can be taken in a couple of ways. It can mean you, all the people, considered as one person, and that in itself creates an idea of unity. Or it can mean each person individually considered, and insofar as each person is being individually addressed, it once again creates unity. It's saying there's nobody that is in some kind of upper status vis-a-vis everybody else. I am the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the house of bondage. So no caste system is contemplated or even permitted with a statement like that. Now, some have disputed that and said, well, look at the tribe of Levi. Weren't they kind of elevated to a superior status? And the answer is both yes and no. They were elevated in the sense that they were designated by Moses as the scholarly class, the priestly class, but at the same time, they were deprived of certain rights that were granted to others, namely rights of perpetual inheritance in the land. And insofar as political power was especially rooted in ownership of the land, Levi was in a sense in a situation where it had its wings clipped, you might say. So the advantages that came to Levi by virtue of being singled out as the scholar class were curtailed and limited by the fact that Levi was also prevented from having additional political power related to the land. Bottom line, this is the whole law for the whole people of God. Social distinctions certainly happened, but they didn't happen by dint of birth. They happened as a result of hard work or giftedness in terms of intelligence, something like that. But we would say in America the same thing. If somebody goes out, rolls up their sleeves and works hard, you know, that they can advance. And if somebody's lazy and doesn't do that, then they're going to wind up worse off. That's not, however, automatic gradations based on birth. That's simply the function of how life is when a person puts their mind to it and tries to improve their situation by simple industry and that sort of thing. All right, well, that's the first one, unity. Moses gives us a justification for a view of ourselves as having unity, and certainly that's one of the most important ideas that you find in traditional American understanding, that we are one nation under God, in the Pledge of Allegiance, and certainly that is compatible with principles that we'd find in Moses. The second one I'm calling liberty, freedom. Freedom basically is my freedom to act within the limits of law. In fact, the phrase law and liberty, that little conjunction of ideas, certainly is part of classical American understanding. Freedom is not possible without law, and the precise reason there is law is to guard my freedom. The idea is that law is going to create a hedge around me, preventing me from being abused by you or anybody else. And within that hedge, I'm free to do what I want. I can pursue the career I want, marry the person I want, get the education I want, that sort of thing. That's liberty. I can do all the things that the law allows me to do, encourages me to do. The only thing I can't do is extend my liberty to the point that it infringes on your liberty. So we have a kind of rational idea of liberty that's constrained by what's good for the rest of the people that live in this culture. Restraint on my liberty that is not directly connected to some idea of the public good is an infringement. When government starts to arbitrarily tell you what you can do and what you cannot do, then that represents an infringement on your liberty. Because liberty is supposed to be traceable to something that I can exercise freely until it somehow is injurious to others around me. And at that point, of course, it's justifiable to have a restraint. The political philosopher Montesquieu said, quote, it consists, that is liberty, consists in the power of doing what we ought to will and in not being constrained to do what we ought not to will. So the liberty is the right, the freedom to do what the law permits. That's a rational, restrained, regulated liberty. And again, we can gather the same thing from the preamble of the Ten Commandments. You may have noticed earlier, I kind of skipped over it, but here it is again, that the people of Israel were taken from the house of bondage. Why is that mentioned? It's to contrast their present situation with their past situation. They were in the house of bondage. Now, of course, the implication is they're in the house of freedom, that they've been brought free from a slave status into a point where they can exercise the liberty that is given to them, secured for them by the ancient Hebrew government, by the government that was supposed to secure those liberties given by God. In the book of Leviticus, Moses says, "I have broken the bands of your yoke and made you go upright." The whole idea that the people have been freed from slavery and they are now liberated to live their lives, delivered from slavery to be free. So Jeremiah asks the question rhetorically, is Israel a slave? And of course, the expected answer is certainly not. We're a free people. Even Jesus met that statement, you know, when he said that these people were enslaved. You may remember in John chapter 8, they said, "We've never been enslaved to any man." Well, actually, they had been over the years, but so deeply ingrained was there in their self-image was the idea of liberty that they would challenge Jesus even at that point. A 19th century political philosopher Christian named Fleury said, quote, "The Israelites were perfectly free. They enjoyed the liberty cherished by Greece and Rome, although never realized by Greece and Rome to the extent the Hebrews did. Such was the purpose of God." So we have unity, we have liberty, finally we have equality. Now, where does this notion of political equality, that is a sort of protection of my political power as an individual person, where does that derive from under the law of Moses? And the simple answer may surprise you, but if you think about it for a moment, I think it'll become obvious that this is in fact the case. It was based on ownership of the land. You know, we have an expression, you've heard it, the American dream. You know, you've heard that. We all have our own little definition of it, but virtually everybody, if you ask them, what's the American dream? Most of them would say it has to do with owning some land. My home in the city, wherever it might be, maybe a couple acres in the country, who knows? White picket fence, you know, all of those things that we think about. But somehow or other, that idea, that classical Americana idea of the American dream, seems to be related, even for us, to ownership of the land. Well, certainly in ancient Israel, it was vastly more that way because they were an agrarian culture, and ownership of the land meant ownership of the means of supporting myself and the means of having a certain degree of political power out there in the public square. If you look at history, you'll see that ownership of the land generally takes one of three forms. Either, and this has been the case in some civilizations down through history, ownership is really relegated to the king. He owns everything, and that basically reduces everybody else to servants of the king. We work the land for him. That's one view. It isn't so common these days, but certainly in history we've seen examples of that. More common would be ownership by the few, a kind of oligarchic ownership of the land. Certainly feudalism had that idea. There were all kinds of ways to own land, lords, barons, that kind of thing. They all had an interest in the land, and everybody else were serfs. They were slaves, basically. In England, there were the landed gentry, as they were called, a minority who owned the land, and then people worked the land. But obviously, the people who owned the land were the people with the power. What we wanted to do in the United States was create ownership by the many. We wanted to make sure that there was a wide distribution of the ownership of land because that would widely distribute political power as well. This is exactly what Moses set up, and I'm telling you that would be virtually unheard of in the ancient world. Moses was innovating light years beyond anything comparable in the ancient world by what he proposed in his legislation. The territory was to be distributed to the people. Numbers chapter 33, beginning at 53, "You shall divide the land by lot as an inheritance among your families. To the larger you shall give a larger inheritance, and to the smaller you shall give a smaller inheritance. There everyone's inheritance shall be whatever falls to him by lot. You shall inherit according to the tribes of your fathers. Land distributed first to the tribes and within the tribes to the people, and that ownership of the land was to be perpetual. It was to continue in perpetuity into the future, guaranteeing that people on an ongoing basis would retain authority, retain power, precisely because they had ownership of the land. The ownership of the land was not ultimately alienable. People could sell it, but it was always understood to be a temporary sale. It would always come back to the original owners, if nothing else, at the time of Jubilee. In Leviticus 25, the land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. God speaking, of course. For you are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the land of your possessions, you shall grant redemption of the land, the right of redemption, and ultimately every 50 years, the Jubilee, restoration of the land to the original ownership. Interestingly, the founders recognized that very principle. They saw that land ownership was extraordinarily important, and many of them address it. John Adams was certainly quite concerned about that. He said, quote, "The agrarian in America is divided into the hands of the common people in every state in such a manner that 19/20 of the property would be in the hand of the commons. Let them appoint whom they might for chief magistrate and senators." He uses the term commons to refer to all of us and say we could elect senators and magistrates, but we sort of retain the authority in ourselves, you see. Adams continues, "The sovereignty then, in fact as well as theory, must reside in the whole body of the people. And even an hereditary king and nobility who should not govern according to the public opinion would infallibly be tumbled instantly from their places." Ownership of the land, protected even under our Constitution and celebrated as a very important aspect. Now, you know, in the modern world, maybe we're not all farmers, I grant that. But that notion that there's a kind of distribution of authority, a kind of equality that's ultimately was traced back to the land, may take various forms today in the modern world, but nevertheless, the principle, I think you see. What are the implications of that? Well, for one thing, it would serve to prevent extreme poverty on the one hand and extreme wealth on the other. It really was a guard against becoming super wealthy or super poverty stricken. A great genius idea there, you might say, in political philosophy. It would arouse an interest in people to work for the common good. If I'm working for the benefit of my land by helping others, then that's the incentive for me to be a public-spirited person, because it's not only good for the community, it also comes back and is good for me as well. And obviously it encourages hard work and productivity. It's interesting once again that in the ancient world and in Israel, the Hebrews were really unique in their celebration of the virtue of hard work. Aristotle, it's foreign to him. He thinks work is something done by slaves. You know, the elite people should sit around and philosophize while the slaves are doing all the work. He was had a very highly stratified view of society in spite of his enlightened insights into some ideas. And of course, the whole point was that work was simply demeaning. It wasn't something that people should have to do unless they were required to do it, but not to the Hebrews. The Hebrews were, of course, deeply committed to the idea of the virtue of work. Solomon said, "Hard work makes rich." The idea of the virtue of hard work is certainly one of the common themes through Scripture, not only by the Old Testament writers, but by the New. You think about what's called the Puritan work ethic. Where did the Puritans get the idea that work was something to be celebrated? What was it that made so many Puritans so rich over the years? Well, it was their understanding of the biblical principle that hard work is productive and that we should do that. It's good for building character. It's good for us. It's good for our families. And it certainly reflects a biblical mandate. The Apostle Paul says to the Thessalonians, if a man will not work, he will not eat. It's a very biblical principle, and certainly it goes to the whole notion of equality that we find in connection with the biblical ethic. Ownership of the land was made permanent by law. The sabbatical year, every 7 years, would involve the forgiveness of debt. the Jubilee year, every 50 years, would actually require that the land go unencumbered back to the original owners. You could sell land for a while, but it would not be sold permanently. That was the principle. And it was a powerful idea that would constantly keep the people in a situation where, at least to the degree it was possible to do so, they would live with human worth, human dignity, surrounded by the great principles of unity and liberty and equality. And so these American Republican ideas that we find here can be traced back to biblical sources. And I think for whatever may be the current situation in our political philosophy and life, to the degree we appreciate that, I think we're moving in a good direction. Well, thanks a lot for joining us for this brief presentation. Hope that's helpful. We'll keep doing these, probably on the order of about one a week here as we can. And so I look forward to seeing you next time. And until then, I pray that God will richly bless you. Thanks again.